Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Hi, folks. I'm here today with Lee Ross. Lee Ross wrote, along with Tom Gilovich, the book The Wisest One in the Room, How You Can Benefit from Social Psychology's Most Powerful Insights. It's a fantastic book. Lee is a professor of psychology at Stanford University, and he's the co-founder of the Stanford Center on Conflict and Negotiations. He is, of course, a great guy and has a lot of very interesting insights, not just about social science and the ways in which we think and act that we can learn from, but how those are applied in life and at work in ways that can actually help us in terms of moving forward. Lee, thank you so much for being on the show and welcome.
It's a pleasure.
You make this distinction very early on in the book, and it's obviously very intentional given the title, about wisdom and intelligence. Can you share that with us?
Well, the word intelligence, we sometimes talk about social intelligence, and the notion of wisdom as I'm applying it comes pretty close to that. The real distinction is that it can be very smart, meaning that they can solve complicated math problems or even do a very good job in lots of contexts that call for you to be smart, but they're not very smart about the way they deal with other people, and they're not sometimes very smart in terms of how they make sense of everyday events. And so that's a little bit of what we mean by wisdom. But we also, it's something we recognize in people when we say, if I was in trouble, here's the person I would want to talk to. Or if I needed advice, here's the person I would go to for advice. And that would very rarely be the smartest person in your office or the person who has the highest IQ or the highest test scores.
That's a brilliant insight. So what is it? If not the highest test scores and the highest IQ or the smartest person, what are the qualities of the person? What are we looking for when we say, this is the person I want to talk to about my problems?
Well, in our book, it very often means the people who are able to recognize and not succumb to many of the sources of bias that influence us and lead us to make bad decisions or lead us to misinterpret behavior or to pursue ways to be happy that don't serve them well.
So you talk a lot about, or at least one of the big things I got from the book is this focus on naive realism, like the idea that if I'm driving in a car, the person who's driving faster than me is an idiot and the person who's driving slower than me is dysfunctional or a jerk. And that basically only the people who drive my speed seem to actually have, you know, smart, capable, good judgment.
Can I give you the actual quote?
Yes, please do.
It's from the great comedian and social satirist, George Carlin. And he said, did you ever notice that anyone driving faster than you is a maniac and anyone driving slower is an idiot?
Right, right. And that's true. You know, like we all can resonate with that. And you really apply it to, for example, political views, how anyone to the left of me is kind of bleeding heart and naive, and anyone to the right of me is selfish and greedy. I'm really curious about that because I've seen it so much since I've read that in the book. And also I'm curious about, like, how can we actually have useful political conversations when we're looking at the people whose views don't agree with ours exactly as either naive or greedy?
Okay, well, there were two parts to that question. The first part, let me just say that naive realism, which is just another way of saying we think that our perspective, we think that our perception of the way things are is the way they really are, that there's a kind of one-to-one relationship between our take on the world and the way the world is, and because of that, anyone who disagrees with us must be wrong, or at least the thing to be explained is why they don't see the world objectively the way we do. And so that makes disagreement have a kind of double-barreled effect, a kind of double-barreled problem. First of all, we disagree, and secondly, we interpret that disagreement not as simply two people who have different experiences, different needs, different priorities, but as a case where I'm right and you're wrong. So that's what naive realism. Now, in terms of getting along with people and making sense of it, we can't not think that our views are correct views, because if we thought our views were incorrect, then of course we'd have different views. So we can't not think that our views are incorrect. What we can do is be more charitable in the way we respond to other people's views. That is, ideally, we can first accept the authenticity of their views. And that is to say, to believe that the people who are talking to us are sincere in what they're claiming they believe and why they believe the way they do. They're not just engaging in some kind of cynical ploy to win an argument. Or at least, they're not doing that any more than we do. The other part of it, very, very difficult, is to realize that while other people do see the world through the prism of their self-interest and their experiences and their prejudices and their education, to realize that we do as well. And that's the tough part.
You know, there's this other thought that I had as I'm listening to you, which is that done well, we can use those conversations to never try to convince someone of someone else. Those are conversations that usually almost always go awry, right? That I'm going to try to change your political view. But to listen as a way of informing us about who they are, meaning not to write them off as, you know, naive or greedy, but to understand that the way they speak informs us about what's important to them, about how they view the world, about what they consider to be kind of just right in terms of a perspective. And that if nothing else, it can inform the relationship. As long as we're not labeling them in a certain way, it can inform the relationship that allows us to get along more effectively.
Right. Well, in the dialogue work that we do in the Middle East and in Northern Ireland, we often emphasize two things. One is that if as inevitably is the case, you disagree with the thing the other person said, instead of jumping in and criticizing or arguing, sometimes it's very effective to just say, tell me why you think that, or tell me why you feel that. Or even better, you might say, okay, I understand why that's the deal you would like to make. Help me understand why you believe it's the deal that I would like to make. So that is a way of continuing the discussion or negotiation, making it clear that you're not going to be taken advantage of, you're not going to be rolled, we would say. You're not giving in anything, and yet you're responding constructively. The second thing is that in a lot of contexts, it's really important where there's disagreement to start out showing that you really do understand and are responding to what the other person says, rather than a kind of stereotype or straw man. So in conflict work that we've done in Ireland a lot, we require unionists and nationalists to every time to say, what I hear you saying is such and such. And you have to keep doing it till the other person says, that's right. That's what I'm saying.
So in effect, you empathize with their perspective so that that you understand their story or perspective bias to their satisfaction.
Right. You don't have to agree with it, but you have to be able to state it in a way that they say, that's right, that's what I'm feeling, or that's what I'm thinking. Because lots of times very unconstructive conversations start out with, well, you're only saying this or you're saying that, when what we're offering is really a caricature of the other person's views. But Peter, I want to emphasize that naive realism doesn't pertain only to political disagreement. It pertains to a lot of everyday stuff. In the book, we talk about some humorous examples, like an older couple disagreeing about the thermostat setting. And one One says the house is too hot, the other says it's too cold, and each thinks there's something wrong with the metabolism of the other person. And they're willing to put up with a crazily hot house in order to satisfy their spouse. But they don't consider the possibility that they're the one whose perception of the temperature of the house is unusual. But this applies to many, many everyday things, disagreements between parents and children about what's a reasonable curfew.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I can resonate with that. And I think when you talked about parenting, right, and the sort of disagreement that a parent and a child have, it brings me to an especially challenging obstacle to overcome, which is the obstacle of rank. That if I have rank in the relationship, it makes my listening different. If I know ultimately with my children that I have the at least at this point in our lives, I have the power in the relationship, in some ways it predisposes me to not listen as much because I know the bedtime is going to be 9 o'clock and they can argue all they want, but I know the bedtime is going to be 9 o'clock. On the other hand,
how old are your children, Peter?
I have an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 13-year-old.
Wait till they're 25 and 20.
Right. Yeah. And at a certain point, that reverses, right? They're going to have rank over me.
Well, they're not going to have rank, but they're going to think that your views are those of a fuddy-duddy, so right. They have to be taken seriously.
Right. I think that's right. And in some ways, it should be easier for me to listen to them and make it really clear and empathize with them because I know I can make the final decision. So it should be easier, but somehow it's a little harder in some ways.
Right. Well, Peter, you're actually intuiting the results of some really interesting research that's been done by a guy named Jamie Pennebaker. He's a professor at Virginia, and he looked at how people who are higher in the hierarchy, in a job hierarchy, for instance, and people lower use pronouns. So your intuition might be that the more powerful people say I all the time, and the less powerful people don't say I. But it turns out to be the opposite, that first person pronouns are used more by people in inferior positions rather than superior ones. And the reason becomes clear once you hear it, and that is the person who's in the superior position tells the other person how the world is. This is the right answer. This is how it is. This is what we're going to do. And the person in the weaker position says, well, in my opinion, and don't you think, and if it were up to me. And so that's kind of an interesting finding. But there is reason to believe that the stronger your position in any hierarchy, the less inclined you are to worry about whether your perspective is a biased one.
And I would imagine it sounds like from that research, which is fascinating, that you just assume that your perspective is the norm and you don't have to question it because nobody forces you to.
Well, it's some combination of I just think I'm right and some combination of it doesn't matter whether I'm right, we're going to do it my way.
Because I have the power to enforce it.
The power or the rank, or you accept it as legitimate. There's
right.
Different kinds of power, but yes.
Let me ask you a question. A main lesson of the book for me was humility, right? The sense that however much I think I'm right, I can't assume that I'm right because there's lots of different perspectives. And it's really helpful to open my mind to all of these other perspectives, to recognize that my perspective, which I land on, is really, very relative. And the question I have has to do with leadership, because in leadership roles...
Wait for a second on what you just said.
Sure, please.
Okay, so let me make it clear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that every opinion is equally valid, that every course of action that gets recommended is equally sensible or equally effective. I'm just saying the test can't be simply how does it seem to us or how objective does our view seem to us. Obviously, experience teaches us that some courses of action are more sensible than others. Research corrects our view of the world. The sun and the moon look to us and look to ancients like they're almost exactly the same size. And they acted on that. They made up moon gods and sun gods and treated them equally. Well, now that we have a lot of scientific tools, we know that that isn't true. But it isn't. We didn't come to that knowledge by just trusting our perceptions. We came to that knowledge by developing techniques and standards for testing ideas and agreeing upon criteria for truth.
That makes a lot of sense, and it answers my other, my question was going to be, how do we act strongly and boldly in the face of the humility that says that, you know, we really may be off? And your answer is clear, which is there are ways of making a probabilistic bet based on data, and that it's the book, in a sense, is a reminder not to just follow our opinions about things, but to actually, you know, look at the data and have a process. Maybe this is the most important thing, a process for making decisions that, you know, isn't based simply on here's what I feel.
Right. We can become wiser. I hope the book contributes to this by knowing some deep things about human beings, about their strengths and their foibles. So, for instance, when we discuss happiness, we talk about the human capacity for adaptation, and that is, we adjust to bad things if they're big more successfully than we might imagine. And when very good things happen, the good feeling wears off pretty quickly. That's an interesting thing and an important thing to know when we're making predictions about the future of other people. We know that people tend to underestimate the extent to which changes in situations produce changes in behavior. That's an important thing to know. So it isn't just a matter of having a lot of data. It's a matter of understanding some important general things about human behavior and human thoughts and human feelings and especially human foibles. But I love your use of the term humility, because one of the things that I found in writing this book and looking at what some wise people have had to say is how often what we really respect in people is a kind of demonstration of intellectual humility. And that is when someone in a high position or in a very historically important role seems to be able to get beyond naive realism. They can't get beyond perceiving the world the way they think it is, but some of them are able to put that aside. We have to think a little bit, not just about what is the situation confronting the other person and what's influencing them, but to recognize what's particular about their own situation and what are the biases they're bringing to their own perspectives.
I mean, and the idea that it's that distinction that you made at the very beginning of the conversation between wisdom and smart, and this idea that, you know, the wise person understands themselves, understands what might derail them, what might give them a perspective in a situation that's different than the audience and the people around them, and that how their choices in that moment should and could, how it impacts your audience and how they are, how the other person is seeing something versus how you're seeing something, and how then to respond in a way that speaks to the reality of the people in the room versus just your reality. In the book, you talk about this sort of doubling the length of a vacation doesn't make a difference, long-term difference in terms of your enjoyment of it. And I wonder how far that gets us. Meaning, if I'm in a job for a year that I don't like versus 2 years or 3 years, like at what point is the length of time, we're talking about 1 week versus 2 weeks of vacation, do you have a sense as to how that relates to longer term endeavors?
Well, this comes out of research that Danny Kahneman and his colleagues did. And the finding, or at least the claim, is that when you look back at things.
Right.
It's very important we're talking about in memory, not the ongoing experience, but when you get back in things in memory, that you show what Kahneman calls duration neglect, that the amount of time isn't as important as how good or bad was it at its best or worst point, and how good or bad was it at the end. So he's basically saying when you look back at a vacation, you won't remember very much of a difference between the week you spent in Hawaii and the 2 weeks you spent in Hawaii, but you will remember, or at least it'll make a difference, whether you remember a perfect day in which you went out on a cruise ship and snorkeled and had a terrific meal, that's what's going to mark how good or bad your memory of this vacation was, rather than just how long it lasted. So that was the claim that was being made. I think it's an interesting one. The most important part of it, from my viewpoint, is simply to acknowledge that the way in which experience contributes to happiness or non-happiness or unhappiness is mainly in terms of the memory that we have of it. So different people respond to different events in different ways. So I may take a terrible camping trip that I had, the worst camping trip in the world, in which it rained and we ran out of food. But in hindsight, if I'm a happy person, it turns out not to be this disastrous camping trip from hell, but this hilarious camping trip from hell. And as you tell the story about it, each terrible thing that happens makes it funnier. Say, and then it started to rain. And even after it started to rain, then we looked and we realized we hadn't brought our boots.
And that's based on your natural level of happiness. That's based on sort of where you start from a happiness perspective.
Well, I think happiness is a kind of virtuous circle. Happy people find it easier to look at the past in ways that make them happier, and look at negative things in a way make them less unhappy. And doing so reinforces their happiness. So I think it's a virtuous circle about happiness, and to some extent a vicious circle with regard to unhappiness. If you're an unhappy person, you think about how good the old days were compared to now, but you remember every insult and every bad thing that happened to you, which makes the past more onerous, which makes you more unhappy.
Lee Ross, thank you so much for writing this book. It's a great book. The Wisest One in the Room, How You Can Benefit from Social Psychology's Most Powerful Insights. It's a really fun read as well as a really educational read. And you don't end up looking at the world in exactly the same way afterwards, which is a really great sign of a really powerful book. Lee, thank you so much for being on the show.
A pleasure, Peter.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.